Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that is going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we ask you to hold your calls for the time being, unless we actually ask for calls, because we have on the line, certainly one of my favorite guests, Ellen Gunderson Traylor, and she has written, I don't know, how many books have you written, Ellen?
It's 17 now, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, it's on Ruth, and it's on your Mary Magdalene. And of course, she has some stories about Israel. All of her books, of course, are biblically centered. And we carry, I think, just about every book she's written on Melchizedek, and certainly so many of the major people in the Bible that you may not even realize their significance. There's a wonderful book on Noah, what things were like at the time of the Great Flood. Anyway, thought maybe this evening we could talk about a series of... Ellen has written a couple of books. They're really modern books. They're really based upon the prophetic nature of Israel and the things that are destined to happen there. And I remember, of course, I remember one of them was called The Priest. What was the other one?
The Oracle.
The Oracle. Well, these are the stories of sort of an Indiana Jones-like character. Why don't you sort of give the background of those stories?
Well, thank you for having me on. The Priest and the Oracle are the two books I've done on current events. All of my others have been historical novels, but these are modern-day stories. In fact, on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, they're billed as international thrillers. And they do follow a character by the name of David Rothmeyer, who is based on a couple of archaeologists that I have met and interviewed over the years over in Israel. He's kind of a composite of them. And it has to do with the rebuilding of the temple in Israel, and which, of course, has not happened yet. But there are a number of movements in Israel, in Jerusalem, related to the attempt on the part of the Jews, their plans to rebuild their temple, which, of course, was taken down, destroyed by the Romans in 70 A.D. As you know, at that point, the Jews were dispersed throughout the world. That's called the diaspora, the dispersion of the Jews, and they lost their homeland. And all through those centuries, even up till this very day, the Jews pray for the rebuilding of their temple so that Messiah can come. Of course, the Orthodox Jews do not believe that Jesus was the Messiah, so they're still looking for him. But in order for him to rule from Jerusalem, he will need a place to do that from. So that's what these stories are about, and they have a lot to do with current events right now.
And really, they're fascinating. It's the wonderful, wonderful stories. But, of course, it's biblical-based. And the thing about Ellen is she goes to these areas. She does a tremendous amount of research, historical and personal research. You know, and so her stories really come alive. And whether it be the story of Mary Magdalene or the story of Noah. But as far as I'm concerned, I love these stories. In fact, Ellen is in the process of coming up with a third in the series, The Priest, The Oracle, and, well, we'll tell you a little bit more about that when we get back here. But this has so much to do with what's really going on today, because a lot of things going on in the Middle East don't make any sense unless you understand their prophetic nature. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, Ellen Gundersen Traynor. Why don't you sort of pick the thought up? I mean, sometimes when you read the news, you have the feeling that if you didn't have any idea what the prophecies were all about, that so much of what's happened and the historical events that led up to the establishment, reestablishment of the nation of Israel, none of these things would have happened.
That's right. And one of the things that I point out in the introduction to my books is that I hope that the readers are paying attention to the news every day, because if they are, that they will see that the scenarios in these books are confirmed on a daily basis in the news. These books were written a few years ago. The Priest came out in 98 and the Oracle in 2001, just a few months before the attack on the World Trade Center. But, you know, when that attack happened, Dr. Stan, I was absolutely deluged with emails from my readers asking me, how did I know that this would happen? Well, I did not write about an attack like that, but I did write about the inevitability of moves against the Western world on the part of Islam, and I did tie in what had already happened at the World Trade Center in 1990 and also 93. You may recall in 1990, Meir Kahane, who was the leader of the Zionist Jews in New York City, was assassinated, and he was killed by the same people who attempted to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And then ultimately, of course, those people were connected with those who did finally destroy the World Trade Center.
And, of course, they were also tied into the Oklahoma City, too, weren't they?
Yes. Well, yes. And so because I had hinted at these things in the books, people were, you know, wanting to know, how did I know these things? And like I say, I didn't foretell that particular kind of a devastation, but you know, the attempt had been made before in 1993, and so I did have that in the story, and I talked about, you know, what was behind that, and you know, to this day, Dr. Stan, it has not really come forth very clearly in the media just why the World Trade Center would have been the target. You know, there have been various theories. Well, they were the tallest buildings in the world.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment.
Okay.
With Ellen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ellen has been simply telling us that after, you know, the attack on the World Trade Center came, so many of the people who had read her books emailed her and wanted to know how she knew it was going to happen, because she had talked about the attack on Meir Kahane back in 1990. He was the led the Zionist Jews in New York, and he was killed by the same people who tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And then, of course, if you read her books, you find there's a tie-in to certainly she had an opportunity of talking to the lawyer who defended Timothy McVeigh that dealt with the Oklahoma City bombing in 1996. And she began to realize, of course, this relationship between the radical movements in this country and the Islamic terrorists in this country. So she was expecting there would be these attacks on the United States, and they're prophesied in her books. And of course, the second book came out, The Oracle, came out in 2001 before the World Trade Center bombing. And I've been waiting ever since 2001 for the next book. And apparently it's on the way very shortly.
It's in the works. I am well into it. And as I have explained before on your program, when that attack happened, I needed time to kind of reconnoiter and digest all of that and then take a while to see where things were going before I moved directly into the next book. But I already had the framework of the story in mind. But anyway, as I was saying, there have been various theories as to why the World Trade Center would have been attacked. But I have my own theory, and I did bring it out in these books, and I bounced it off Stephen Jones, who was Timothy McVeigh's attorney, and you know, he seemed to be quite collaborative with me on that. Would you like to hear my theory?
Yes, you go right ahead.
Okay. Well, my theory is that it was not because they were the tallest buildings in the world, or that because it was New York City in particular, which is so important to our country. But actually, and it wasn't an attack so much on the Western world, which is what we've been hearing, isn't it? That it was an attack against the Western culture. My belief is that even more important than those theories, and those have their place, but is that it was the headquarters of world Zionism, the headquarters of all the wealth of the Zionist Jews in the world, was headquartered in the World Trade Center. What this was, Dr. Stan, in my opinion, was an attack on Israel. The Jewish people, and particularly the Temple Movement. Israel and the Temple Movement had its sponsors in the World Trade Center. And one good reason to take it down would be to short-circuit that flow of funds going to Israel, and some of which was going into the Temple Movement.
All right, fine. And so this then takes us back to what is happening in Israel. And this is the most amazing story. I mean, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. The Jewish people were dispersed throughout the world. And now, at this time in history, they've suddenly gone back to Israel. And, of course, they established the State of Israel in 1948. Now, what other country has ever been dormant for almost 2,000 years and suddenly reconstituted? And then war after war after war, and each war the Israelis should have lost.
Yes.
I mean, by all right, there's no earthly way that they could have prevailed.
No.
But I don't believe that there was an earthly way, do you?
No, it was not an earthly thing. It is, it's a divine intervention. And that is not to say that all Jews are righteous or that Israel is always right in everything it does. What it does say is that God had a foreordained plan for Israel. It was prophesied time and time again in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that Israel, God had not forgotten his people, his chosen people, and that he would bring them back into the land again. And this, of course, is what happened in 1948. It was an outgrowth of the Holocaust in Europe, where Hitler thought he had squashed the Jews forever, but instead they rose from the ashes. And not only individuals survived, but they founded a land and a country again, which, as you say, had been dormant for 2,000 years. What other society has managed to keep its language and its traditions and its culture intact when they were dispersed all over the entire world for 2,000 years? It is an unheard of story, except for the story of Israel.
And, of course, the things that you bring out in your book, the fact that the Jewish leaders, the Jewish priests, have always felt that they wanted to have somebody of the direct lineage of the original Jewish priests. And they want to tell a little bit about that, because they actually, the only way that they could tell who the right people were was with DNA that was available now that had never been available until this time in history.
Right.
And that's such a fascinating story. Would you like to develop those ideas?
Yes. Just a few years ago, a man was sitting in a synagogue, a Jewish man was sitting in a synagogue, and he was observing the Cohen males, who the Cohens are the keepers of the priesthood of Israel, and the Levites, of course, are also the keepers of the priesthood. The Cohens are the ones from whom the high priest of Israel would come, and the name Cohen, Dr. Stan, is like the name Smith in English. It is so common They say there are as many Cohens in New York City as there are bagels in the bakeries. And so who's to say that, you know, which one of these would be the heir to the high priesthood of Israel? Well, this particular man happened to be a genetic scientist. And he came up with an idea. He knew that if you took the saliva of an individual, you could test it for various chromosomal points and so forth, and the DNA. And so he actually began a scientific study. He and a cohort of his began a scientific study. They went all over the world, and they collected saliva samples from people who claimed to be of the Cohen lineage. Now, incredibly, there were black people in Africa. There were people in Ireland. There were people in Taiwan. I mean, we're talking, this cuts across racial and cultural barriers entirely. But these people had some strain of family history that told them that they were of this background. Well, so he decided to follow this thing through, and he collected all these samples and studied them and found that in the vast number of cases, these people had a specific genetic marker in their chromosomes, which was unique to the Cohen lineage. He took Cohen, people who, there was no doubt of their Cohen lineage. It went back and back throughout their family history. No doubt they were of the Cohen lineage. He discovered they all had this marker, and then he studied these others who you would think would not even be Jews, let alone Cohens, and found that indeed many of them also had this same marker. And so what he found here was that the Cohen lineage has been kept remarkably untainted down through 4,000 years, 3,500 years of history from the time of Moses on. So we're going back three and a half centuries, okay? And so then it's just a step from there, Dr. Stan, taking genealogies, taking studies of names and tracing them back through etymology, taking all kinds of scientific studies and bringing them together. At some point, you could actually narrow the field down and ultimately designate that one person who would be the ultimate high priest of Israel. Now, why is this important? Because without the high priest of Israel, you cannot, even if you have a temple, you won't be able to conduct anything in it. So here, all of a sudden, in the 21st century, the end of the 20th century, we have all these things coming together. We have the nation of Israel founded. We have these DNA capabilities, which we've never had before. We have movements in Israel rebuilding, getting ready to rebuild the temple, which has been prophesied. We have the implements, the harps, the vestments, all these things being designed and planned and built right now for that ultimate temple. And why is that important to us as Christians? Because we know that Jesus Christ, when he returns as the Messiah, will reign from that temple.
But before that, of course, somebody else will reign there, won't they?
They will.
And this is the thing. You see, the Jews are waiting for the return of their Messiah. They're going to be misled that their Messiah is, but he's not. He's going to be the Antichrist.
That's right.
And in a similar manner, the Muslims wait for the return of the Mahdi, and they believe that he is going to be the great ruler. The Hindu waits for the return of Maitreya. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Christian waits for the return of Jesus Christ, the one true God. And really, what an exciting time, because we see all of these various things fitting together. There are people in Iran today who want to bring on a world chaos so the Mahdi can return
right.
and bring us all under their control. Well, why don't you just pick up the story there? Certainly, the group, they call them the Temple Mount Group, and you sort of weave their story into your books, don't you?
Well, my agency and my book is called the Temple Consortium, and it is based on a group, an actual group in Jerusalem today called the Temple Institute. There is another group called the Temple Mount Faithful, and yet others. But the most scholarly, really, of them all, and the ones which have put the most financial backing into all of this, is the Temple Institute. And the rabbis in my books are based on people that I actually met there at the Temple Institute. All of my characters in my books have their roots in adventures that I myself had going across the world studying for this and meeting people and interviewing them. I had many great adventures, and actually I was even followed quite a bit of the time, particularly when we were in Germany and England, you know, I had so many contacts with various rather controversial characters that I'm sure the powers that be, you know, that watch these things were well aware of my activities, and my husband and I were definitely under surveillance as we traveled through Europe and England.
Well, do you think you were under the surveillance by the Mossad or what?
No, you know, it mainly took place in England. I think it did happen in Germany, but I think it was all connected. And we have talked to a number of people since that happened, and they've given us their ideas of who it really was. But we had hooked up with the head of B'nai B'rith in London, and from that point on, we were definitely being tracked. And I think what happened was that B'nai B'rith, along with the British intelligence, was watching us very carefully. We were asking a lot of very, very sensitive questions. I had been emailing for months across the world, and making phone calls, having phone conversations with, you know, a lot of sensitive characters, both in the United States and elsewhere. And I think, knowing what I do about Interpol, you can only do so much of that before it's picked up on.
Well, of course, the thing is that British intelligence, as American intelligence, has a strong tie into the occult, who would be very, very interested and very concerned about too much coming out of the truth about what's really going on behind the scenes.
Well, I could tell you some very spine-tingling stories about our adventures, but just to give you an example, in London, every day when we would come back to our hotel, the locks had been changed on the door, and we had to go down to the main desk and get somebody to come up and reprogram the entrance to our door. You know, it had the...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, Ellen has been saying that when she and her husband were traveling in Europe, and they were, of course, been doing a lot of research for her books, and actually, of course, she and her husband were followed in England and presumably in Germany as well. And certainly she thinks it's tied into British intelligence, and I would certainly concur, knowing what I do, that there are elements within British intelligence, going all the way back to into the 1500s in the time of Bloody Mary, Queen Mary, and Francis Bacon. Elements of the British intelligence were involved in the occult. They still are, as with certain elements within our own intelligence agencies, the Central Intelligence Agency. There really are these occult forces out there who are very aware of the spiritual implications of everything going on in the world today, because behind everything happening politically and militarily and educationally and culturally are these occult forces. Would you agree with that?
Oh, well, everything goes back to good and evil, doesn't it?
It sure does.
But, you know, even if it weren't an actual occult thing, it was definitely a politically sensitive situation that we were involved in. And I'm not saying that it wasn't connected to the occult as far as those who were concerned about what we were doing. But I am saying, even if it wasn't involved with that, the things that we were dealing with were getting at issues that were so sensitive. When I spoke with Stephen Jones for 3 hours face-to-face one day.
Now, for our listener, Stephen Jones was Timothy McVeigh's attorney. Go ahead.
Yes. He told me that he could not tell me anything, but he said, you tell me what you think, and I will tell you yes or no. And so for 3 hours, I gave him my theories, which were going to be woven into my books, and he would sit there and say, yes, 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 yes. You have it. Yes, you have it. So we know that his life, the life of his family, was threatened repeatedly. He was in a very sensitive situation there.
And, of course, what he had really uncovered was the relationship between the radical militia groups in America and the Islamic terrorists. Would that be a fair statement?
That and the FBI.
Right.
Remember when 5,000 pages of material were just accidentally misplaced in the courtroom?
Right. And, of course,
and that was material that the FBI did not want to come to light.
Well, they don't dare let the American people know the truth about what really happened with Oklahoma City bombing, what happened at Waco, what happened with the downing of TW-800,
right.
And certainly never to know what really happened on the morning of September 11th.
Right, right. Well, anyway, as I'm kind of getting off the track of our original subject, I guess, but I don't think I had ever told you this, had I?
No, you haven't.
That my husband and I were tracked that way. And spine tingling, we at the time, to be quite frank, we didn't really know what was going on. I mean, it's like it took a while to sink in, but I can remember one evening when we got back to our hotel and we couldn't get in again because supposedly something had happened to the locks. It was one of these digital lock things, you know, that you had to use a card on. When we got in there, I just had this feeling that things were not the way we had left them. And I could not lay my finger on it, but I just knew that our bags, the things that we had left lying around, were not quite the way we had left them. And my husband and I decided then and there that we would not discuss anything to do with my research in the room. But the next day, when we went out, everywhere we went, from the moment we stepped out of the hotel until sunset when we headed back to the hotel, the same pair of very peculiar-looking people showed up at every single place we went to. I mean, these were very unusual-looking man and woman. They stood out like sore thumbs, and we've been told since then that that was on purpose.
To intimidate you.
Yes, so that we would realize we were being followed. Mm. And we tested it at one point. We were standing outside the Tower of London, and I turned. They were sitting over on a bench, and I said, "Dick, I'm going to pretend I'm taking a picture of the London Bridge, and I'm going to turn and take one of them." And as I turned, they were gone. And then we said, okay, we're going to walk over and try to find Shakespeare's Globe Theater. It was about four bridges down. It took about an hour to get there. And when we got there, they were sitting on a bench right outside the Globe Theater.
We'll be back in just a moment with Ellen Gutness and Trailer. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this may sound rather dramatic, but this sort of thing does happen. Of course, what Ellen was doing, they were beginning to try to understand all the things that were going to have to be necessary before the sacrifices could begin on Temple Mount. Now, to actually have the temple, these sacrifices there, they're going to have to build a tabernacle, and some people think they're going to have to destroy the Dome of the Rock, this beautiful Muslim church that was written there, a mosque that was built there, you know, in the late 600s. But under any circumstances, before they can begin doing that, they have to have the ashes of the red heifer. And you actually analyzed each one of the things that would be necessary. And there are not that many things once they know who the priest is. Mm-hmm. They probably know exactly where the Ark of the Covenant is. Mm-hmm. But what about the ashes of the red heifer? Why is that important?
Well, that's my second book, The Oracle. In the first book, they're looking for the legitimate heir to the high priesthood, and David Rothmeyer, being a linguistic archaeologist, is enlisted to track down the genealogy and the DNA and so forth to locate the high priest. In The Oracle, he is looking for the implements necessary for the high priest to do his duties, which would be the ashes of the red heifer and the Urim and Thummim, which would be a device called the, which I call the oracle. It's a device which can supposedly interpret the will of God. So again, he takes off on a globe-hopping journey, and these books weave several stories together in one, don't they, Dr. Stan?
Yes, they do, and you do that so well, you know, all these various stories, and then the end of the book, they all come together.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, it's called a convergent novel, for those of you who like to study literature, but it takes all these different strands of story. And in the case of The Oracle, we're weaving together a number of interesting scenarios, and the same in The Priest, in both of them. We have an old Irish Catholic priest who teaches at Oxford and who has kept a secret for 40 years. Only he knows where this thing is, and it is the final key to the genealogy of the high priest, and I won't tell you what that is right now. And in the second one, we have some characters in Montana who get involved with people in...
Hold that thought right there.
Okay.
We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ellison is simply going into the background of how these stories weave together, the convergence novels. In other words, there are three or four different storylines, and they all come together in the end. But, of course, the story deals the first... first book, which is The Priest, deals with David Rothmeyer trying to track down the priest, the man who will be the high priest. And actually, this sort of thing has really gone on. It wasn't David Rothmeyer, because he's a fictional character, but there really has just been a desire to find the man who will be the high priest when they begin the sacrifices there in the temple. And then of course, with the second the book, it's called The Oracle, and it's the effort to find the ashes of the red heifer. You have to have an unblemished red heifer, and if you can find one today, fine, or you have to have the ashes of the last red heifer that was sacrificed, and we're going back almost 2,000 years. And then, of course, The Oracle, which is something that allows people to know the will of God. So pick up the story there.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, in these books, you have these diverse characters who don't seem to be connected until you you really get into it, and then you find that they're all woven together. But we hop from Montana to Columbus, Ohio. We have a bunch of bikers chasing after a Jewish girl who has one of the keys to all this. You know, it sounds, when I talk about it, like so much hodgepodge and really just ridiculously complex. But, you know, really that's the way it is when you set out to piece the truth together. It takes you into all kinds of places, and you meet all kinds of people that you never dreamed you would ever need to talk to.
And, of course, really, they're fascinating adventure novels. They're the sort of novels you just don't want to put down. And, people talk about the Da Vinci Code. These are every bit as exciting as Dan Brown's book, only these are based upon biblical truth, not the effort to destroy Christianity, which was Dan Brown's goal. In fact, I think these would make wonderful, wonderful movies.
Well, I should tell you right now, I will ask for your prayers. One of my books is in the hands of a producer who made the two biggest selling movies of all time. He made Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And he has Noah right now.
Really?
Yeah.
I would think he'd be more interested in the priest.
Well, maybe we'll have to give that to him next. But anyway, he has Noah. But that's aside from what we're talking about. I'd love to see these made into films. I think they... Well, did you see National Treasure?
Yes,
Is this... You know, that has some of the same flavor to it, but it's not based on truth at all, whereas these are. So, do you want to hear about the third one?
Yeah, sure, I do.
Okay, well, the third one is called The Cornerstone. And in this one, David Rothmeyer is enlisted to figure out where the temple actually stood on Mount Moriah.
And, of course, if you've ever been to Mount Moriah, this probably would have a lot more meaning to you because, of course, the golden doors there, and it's prophesied that they would never be opened until Christ would come through them. And they've been sealed shut for, all these thousands of years?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Arabs sealed them shut, the Muslims, under Suleiman, believing that they could keep the Messiah out just by filling them in. And then they put a graveyard in front of them, believing that the Messiah would never walk through a graveyard. But what they failed to account for was the resurrection. But anyway, yes, they thought they could keep Messiah out, but they will not keep him out. He'll come through the eastern gate, and he'll take his place in the temple.
Right, because in the meantime, they're going to have to get the temple built. And the question then is, where on the Mount Moriah will the temple go?
Well, and the reason that is so important and so sensitive is because the Dome of the Rock is up there. Al-Aqsa Mosque is there. And that is Arab territory. That's an Arab sanctuary. Of course, they believe that Muhammad took his night ride to heaven on that, from that rock that's under the dome. But we know that that rock was part of the, it was the original threshing floor that King David bought to build the temple on. And so the courtyard actually contained that rock, and very likely the sacrifices were made there.
And, of course, that was supposedly where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac.
Right, exactly. That was the original spot, and also Jacob had his dream there. That was the rock that he made his pillow and slept on, and a pillow in the Near East is a big couch. It's not just something under your head. But he slept on that rock and had his dream of the ladder stretching to heaven. Moriah, by the way, means wisdom teacher, teacher of wisdom. So if we can get a grasp on how important that location is in the mind of God and what it really means in his economy and in his purposes in the world, then we begin to become wise. our eyes are opened to the purposes of God in the world when we start to understand his purposes with Israel. And his purposes with Israel center on that holy place. When Jacob awoke from his dream there, he said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. Surely this is the gate of heaven." So he had actually seen the gate of heaven and the angels coming and going between earth and heaven right there. So that it's a very deep and very profound thing we're talking about here, and that's why Satan is so anxious to keep it under his own control.
And because the thing, the implications of what we're really talking about, we're talking about people, Jewish rabbis, who are actually planning on rebuilding the ancient temple that was destroyed in 70 A.D. And they're getting, they have all the implements together. Have they got the ashes, the red heifer yet?
No, they don't have that yet.
But they're looking. They're looking all over the world for an unblemished red heifer without one gray hair or anything on it.
And also they're looking for the original ashes. They need one or the other, like you said. If they can't find the original ashes, and we really haven't explained what these ashes were used for.
Why don't you explain to our listeners?
Moses, in Leviticus, talks about how the priest would purify himself so that he could go in and offer atonement for the people. And the way he was purified and the way the implements of the sacrifices were purified was by having water mixed with the ashes of this red cow sprinkled on them. That was the purification. I don't know what you'd say there. There probably wasn't a chemistry that happened, but, you know, it was an act of obedience on the part of the people to follow what God told them to do, and this is what God said would be the ritual purification of the priest. So now that the original red heifer's ashes were kept in an urn, and as they would begin to dissipate and they'd get down where there wasn't much left, they would kill another cow. Didn't have to be a pure red one, but just another cow, and sprinkle it with the ashes. So then its ashes were considered pure, okay? So you have the original ashes being used to sprinkle the next cow, and then its ashes and so on being used. In the time of Jeremiah, when the Babylonians were getting ready to invade, Jeremiah is the last one who mentions, who seems to have had the ashes of the red heifer. And we don't know what he did with them. If that could be discovered, and that's what my book, The Oracle, is partly about, is what did Jeremiah do with the ashes? Where did he take them? Where did they end up? There are a lot of theories about that. If they could be found, that would solve the problem. In the meanwhile, if in case they're never found, the other alternative is to find another pure red heifer with only no more than three white hairs on it. And they have thought they found it a few times. There was one in Texas, there was one in Sweden, but it always ended up that they were not.
And then, of course, the other thing is the Ark of the Covenant. Don't they have to have the Ark of the Covenant?
That seems to be somewhat debatable as to whether they'll actually have to have the Ark of the Covenant or not. I think they would. I don't know why they wouldn't, because in the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, part of it was the mercy seat, where the Shekinah glory of God would come and settle on that. So I believe that they would have to have the Ark of the Covenant. And there are different theories as to where it might be. I did not go into that in either of my books because it's been done to death. You know, there have been so many stories written about it in movies, and you know, I didn't go into the Ark of the Covenant. But there are some various stories about where it might be.
So of course, some people think it's in Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians think it's in Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are other people who think it's hidden in a cave not too far from Jeremiah's grotto.
And possibly underneath the Well of Souls, or the Well of the Spirits. No, excuse me, the Dome of the Spirits on Mount Moriah.
Okay, and so these are things that, of course, the Jews spend full time studying
right.
in preparation. I mean, they're the people who've been working at this literally for dozens of years.
Mm-hmm.
And they are all prepared. They feel the time is very close, don't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But see, if you go to Israel today and you talk to these people and you talk to anybody over there in the know on this, they will say that the moment we set foot on Temple Mount to do this, World War III will break out.
Well, of course, the thing is, what I think most people do not understand, there are people within the Iranian government. One of them, I believe, is the current president, Ahmadinejad.
Right.
I think he wants to bring about World War III. This is why he's doing everything that is totally irrational. I mean, saying that the Holocaust didn't take place, we've got to wipe Israel off the face of the world, we've got to suddenly move Israel to Europe, we're going to go ahead and develop our nuclear material, and we're not going to work with the Russians, we're going to do it our way. And it's almost as if he is intentionally doing everything he can to inflame the Israelis and the Americans to precipitate an attack on his country, which could very well precipitate World War III.
Well, he knows that the Israeli weapons are poised right at him, and that they would not hesitate to do a preemptory strike. According to things that I have read and which you have in fact shown me and sent to me, they believe that this 12th Imam will not reveal himself until there is a cosmic chaos and war and a huge confrontation between good and evil, and then he will usher in an era of universal peace. But in order for him to come, there has to be war first.
And, of course, the 12th Imam is really the Mahdi, the returning of the prophet.
Right, uh-huh. And he's been in hiding since the 9th century, supposedly. They're just waiting for him to come back. But they're trying to help him out by creating this, by baiting the rest of the world.
Isn't that really the most incredible story?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that just before you called, and to me, it's a fulfillment of Genesis 16:12, which says, Ishmael shall be a wild man, his hand against every man, and every man's hand against him. Never before in history has there been this possibility, this potential, that one race of people, being the Arab people descended from Ishmael, would actually have the capacity to be, have their hand against everybody else on earth. And doesn't that sound like what they've been doing for the past few years? You know, New York City wasn't the only place that was hit. There was Barcelona. There was, they've been acting up in London, in Russia, the Philippines, the Sudan, Pakistan. I mean, this is all over the world.
Sure, Jordan.
They're attempting to stir up trouble everywhere against people who've never even been their enemies. Well, and this is the only time in history when that prophecy has the potential of being fulfilled.
Well, I think that we are living, Helen, in some of the most exciting times in history. And really what a privilege it is, at least to have a glimpse of what's going on. We don't have all the answers, But all the answers really are there in the scriptures. It's just a matter of piecing them together, and you've done such a wonderful job in your books. I should tell our listeners, we do carry both The Priest and The Oracle, and if you haven't read Ellen's books, you really missed a treat. Certainly my wife has read all of them, my secretary has read all of them. I've read most of them, because I have to read them before I do the interviews, and I always enjoy them, and they're most wonderful. Biblical ones based on the Bible are just taking the scriptures and studying the scriptures, and then, of course, taking a little bit of literary license to make the story come together. But they're really fascinating books. If you'd like to know more about them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We're talking about The Priest and the Oracle. Those are two more modern books, but the rest of them are really all based upon biblical characters, and they all come alive. Ellen has a wonderful gift. Certain people have a gift of writing novels, and these are wonderful, wonderful novels. I know my wife is one of your greatest admirers.
Well, thank you. I'd like to just, if I have a moment, I don't know how we're doing time-wise, mention one incident that happened about a month ago that was really like taken from one of the books.
Go ahead.
Do you remember in Toledo, Ohio, when they unearthed a cell of Al-Qaeda members?
Right.
Okay. The Priest, we have a cell of I didn't call them Al-Qaeda, but I called them jihadists, located in western Montana. And, you know, I have said all along that the Elohim City Bunch, where Timothy McVeigh was groomed, was all tied in with Al-Qaeda in the Philippines.
Hold, we'll be back in just a moment here. Why don't you pick up the story there, Ellen?
Well, we know that the people of Elohim City, where Timothy McVeigh and his cohort, what was it, Terry Nichols, were groomed.
This was a Christian Identity Center there, and a center run by Reverend Millard there in Oklahoma, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, right. In Oklahoma, right. And anyway, they were trained by a guerrilla warfare teacher, a German, and I pattern one of my characters in The Priest after him.
Andy Strassmeyer.
Yes. You remembered. Okay. Anyway, he was originally training Al-Qaeda in the Philippines, Dr. Stan.
I didn't know that, but
yes.
That wouldn't be a total surprise. He was obviously in German intelligence. So.
Yes. Yeah, and I didn't tell you about being followed in Germany, but that's the whole of the story. But... So anyway, yes, this cell in Toledo is just one of many, 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 many which will be found, and they will find that they are tied in with Aryan Nations groups around the country.
Now, what you're suggesting then is that the Islamic terrorists are working with the Aryan Nation groups. In other words, you have these two groups, one of the radical so-called right, and the other, I don't know if you want to call them radical left, call them what you will. All of these revolutionary groups based upon hatred of America interlocked, and we see this in South America where Hugo Chavez, who's a dedicated Marxist, is working with the Iranian militants.
And some of Sinn Féin and the Irish revolutionaries,
right,
are somewhat tied in. Terror is terror, and these people help each other.
They sure do.
One of the things that the Irish revolutionaries have in common with the Arab people and with the Aryan Nations people is the hatred of Israel, hatred of the Jews, and this goes clear back into the Middle Ages. This is one thing that I really try to bring out in my books, is that radical Islam and radical freedom movement here in this country are in cahoots, at least on one thing, not only hatred of the American government, but hatred of Israel. and they support one another in endeavors that attempt to bring Israel down.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening has been Ellen Gundersen Traylor, and she's just pointing out that the radical militant militia groups here and anti-Semitic groups are certainly working in league with the Islamic terrorists because of a common hatred of Israel, and they all want to destroy Israel. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, definitely. Yes, absolute anti-Semitism.
And it's growing all across America. That's unfortunately, but it's a reality that we have to face.
Well, we have to figure that Hitler, he's the forefather, at least in the Western world, of the Nazi movement. And then you have people like this Muhammad, I don't have it in front of me, Ahmadinejad.
Ahmadinejad, right.
Yeah, the president of Iran, he almost looks like Hitler, he swaggers like him, he talks like him, he gestures like him. And, this is nothing new. In the story of Esther, Haman was just like that.
Hey, we could go on for an hour, but we're out of time.
Oh,
it's been
okay.
Such a great pleasure. Can I really call you and get you onto some of our other programs? Maybe we could do a program some evening where we could take the full 2 hours, if you wouldn't mind.
This is fun. I really enjoy it, and I'm always happy to help out. May I give my website?
You please do.
Okay. It's very simple, ellentraylor.com. That's ellentraylor, all one word, .com.
And Ellen's books are wonderful. And ellentraylor.com. God bless you. We'll be talking to you later.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.
All right. That was Ellen Gundersen Traylor, and certainly one of my favorite authors. I hope she'll become one of yours. If you'd like to know more about her books, I think we carry all of them. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We were talking primarily tonight about the priest and the oracle. And if you enjoyed the Da Vinci Code, you'll love these books. These are fast-moving adventure novels that are never going to get the play that the others will. Why? Because they're Christian novels. They're written from a Christian perspective. And, of course, they will certainly bring you into a closer personal relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ. So let me recommend the books to you. Fascinating. All of her Ellen books are wonderful. In fact, we really should get Ellen on a more regular basis. Certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope yours as well. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really depend on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every weekday, and then we do our weekend programs as well. And we spend our time full-time trying to educate the American people about this spiritual battle in which we're engaged. And if you'd like to help us, join the Radio Liberty family. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call. Our February newsletter will give you some real insight into the war on terrorism, at least. Well, that's what they call it, a war on terrorism. But is it really a war on terrorism, or is there another agenda? Our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. And, of course, then, please pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Till we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And right now, of course, I'm asking you to hold your calls. Your telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We'll open up at the very end of the program. Mr. Dreyfus, who's our special guest this evening, can only be with us for about 40 minutes. But Mr. Robert Dreyfus has written a fascinating book called The Devil's Game. Now, have you ever wondered where this whole radical Islamic movement came from? I mean, did it just sort of come out of nowhere? Did it really begin when Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen were fighting in Afghanistan in the 1980s? Or where did it really begin? Well, Mr. Dreyfus has traced the history of this movement back to really the 1860s, 1880s, to another time and another era. And I think you'll be surprised at how this whole thing came about. Mr. Dreyfus, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's really my pleasure.
And now, remember, this is a different audience, so you can repeat everything you've said before, and I think they'll be fascinated. First of all, how is it that you happened to write this book? Because it's a very important book. We needed to get into the background of what's the origin of this radical form of Islam that is really a threat to the survival of Christian civilization today.
Well, you know, like any religion, Islam has had conservative and moderate and liberal and free-thinking versions going back centuries. But really, I would say in the 20th century, there started to emerge an organized force of what I would call the Islamic right. These were groups that were ultra-conservative, but also organized in a political way. And you can date it, I guess, for the sake of argument, with the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in the 1920s. And by the time of the Cold War, the Muslim Brotherhood had grown into a fairly significant organization in Egypt and other countries from Syria and Jordan and Pakistan and elsewhere. And during those years, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the Muslim Brotherhood often worked with some of the most reactionary elements in the region, got funding from Saudi Arabia's ultra-conservative Wahhabi clergy. They developed relationships with the various kings, like the king of Egypt, Farouk, and also with the British. The British saw these Islamic groups as potentially useful allies in battling some of the anti-colonial movements and the anti-imperialist forces that were trying to get the British out of Suez or out of India and so forth.
And, of course, they really were not interested in Arab nationalism. They really wanted sort of an Arab internationalism, but they were quite willing to make common cause with the British. And wasn't British intelligence and then sometime later the CIA involved with helping these organizations, this radical Islamic movement?
That's right. When the Cold War started, after World War II, and the United States started to replace the British as the main power in the region, the United States started to see these Islamic groups as allies.
And, of course, I think this is the part of the story that nobody likes to talk about today, that at least as you read the book, you find out that many times it was American money that was helping to actually foment this whole radical Islamic movement. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and perhaps could we, before we get too far into what's going on today, how about let's go back to the very beginning. You describe a gentleman named Afghani. Afghani wasn't an Afghani at all. Apparently he was a Persian, but this was, what, the 1860-1880 period? Would you like to go into the background there of where this really began? Of course, we always had the Wahhabis, but then there was this other gentleman who played such an important part as a forerunner of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, Afghani is a very important and fascinating figure. He died in the, I guess, the 1890s after a 30-year career as almost a whirling dervish organizer. He traveled from Persia to Afghanistan to India to Egypt to Turkey. He spent years in Europe, and he founded along the way a whole series of pan-Islamic secret societies.
Now, pan-Islamic secret societies. So there really were secret societies involved in this then?
Yes, they were, sort of underground movements of people who did not admit, publicly that they belonged to these movements, but they had a kind of a secret knowledge. And this was not... This was, common at the time. There were Freemason movements and others that existed at this point, some of them quite innocuous, others perhaps more political. And Afghani interacted with them as well, various Freemason lodges in places like Cairo and in Turkey. But he was really the architect, the first one who came up with this idea of a political movement to unite Islam. But it wasn't as, pristine or honest as you might think, because he tried to sell this idea with varying degrees of success to the British and the Russians and others who were engaged in a fairly high-stakes, what they called the Great Game at the time, struggling over the Middle East and Central Asia, competing, that is, the British versus the Russians, in competing for influence in that part of the world. And Afghani proposed, especially to the British, who apparently helped him during important parts of his career, to try to unite the Muslims in alliance with Britain in kind of a pan-Islamic bloc that would be pro-British and would support London's efforts against Russia.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Robert Dreyfuss, and we're talking about his book, Devil's Game, which we think is a very important book, and it goes into the background of a man, we've been talking about him, his name was Afghani, he was really a Persian, but he was trying to pose as an Arab, and he was really pushing this idea of pan-Islam, or uniting the whole world, and something called a caliphate, something would really unite the Muslim world against the rest of the world. But he was using British intelligence. He himself was a Freemason, but he had contacts with British intelligence, and then, of course, apparently he was, had contacts with the Russians. He was willing to go any place that he could get support. But actually, didn't he end up as the prime minister of one of the countries over there for a time?
He became prime minister of Iran for a while, and he was eventually kicked out of Iran, and one of his followers ended up assassinating the Shah, who was a longtime king of Persia until the 1890s, and then he ended up dying a few years later. But he left a legacy. He was sort of the ideological grandfather of this pan-Islamic movement. Now, I should say, by the way, there's nothing wrong with uniting Islam, just the way there's nothing wrong with uniting the 50 states of the United States into a republic. But this was an explicitly political plus religious effort that had a very, I think, perverted notion of what Islam really means. It's an originalist kind of 7th century version of an Islamic empire that imposed an outlook which was very anti-modern, which certainly would not fit with modern learning and science and political freedoms. So here was a case where it was an explicit attempt to bring that part of the world really backwards, away from the modernizing outlook of the 19th and 20th centuries. And his followers were primarily based in Egypt. He spent years there himself, and he had a follower, a man named Abdu, Muhammad Abdu, who again became very close to the British colonial powers in Cairo. Abdu, in turn, was the godfather politically of a man named Hassan al-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. And it's widely recognized by scholars of Islam, political Islam, that Afghani, Abdu, and Banna, those three, are kind of like grandfather, father, and son in the movement that created the modern version of political Islam. And of course, what gave it a big boost was after the Saudi Arabian Kingdom was established, also in the 1920s, and also, by the way, by the British, the Saudis became the financial backers of the Muslim Brotherhood for the next, 75 years, I would say, until 9/11. And so Saudi Arabia, which was based on this very ultra-Orthodox Wahhabi version of Islam, found that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was the best expression of that outside of Saudi Arabia. And so the Saudis and the Muslim Brotherhood became kind of an alliance which has lasted for many decades. And it was this alliance that the United States encountered when it was looking for allies in the region in the 1950s that were both anti-communist and opposed to some of the upstart nationalists like Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. And so for these two reasons, because the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudi Wahhabis were strongly anti-communist, and because they were strongly anti-nationalist, they got American backing, and we played various political games with them over the years. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Afghan Jihad, which was the most pure expression of that alliance. But, you know, in my book, I go into many other examples and background on how this theory developed of Islam as a barrier to communism. And of course, the problem with all this, you can say, well, anything goes during the Cold War. I happen to think that playing with religion is extremely dangerous. It's not the same thing as paying off some colonel or buying, you know, funding some political party or something, because religion is a very uncontrollable force. And, of course, then we found out after the Cold War that these religious fundamentalists had their own agenda. They weren't just anti-communist, but once the Soviet Union was gone, they turned and expressed the anti-Western component of their political and religious philosophy.
Well, before we get into that, and I think that's a very important issue, but I just want to get back to Afghani, and I thought one of the most significant things I learned from reading your book is that Afghani, the father or the grandfather, as it were, of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it was two generations after Afghani was presiding and there in the Middle East, that we had the Muslim Brotherhood created in 1928, but Afghani kept talking about Allah and about the Islamic faith and professes this deep belief. And yet you pointed out that he really didn't believe in Allah. He didn't believe in God. It was really all about a political struggle, about a power structure. That was really a very interesting point.
Yeah, he believed apparently in the what analysts have called the political utility of religion. In other words, He believed in the secret truth and then a public truth.
In other words, he was talking about the dedicated belief to Allah and the dedication to this going back to it was the time of the Prophet, but he really didn't believe it at all. It was simply used as a vehicle to get ahead?
Yes, well, I don't know about to get ahead. That's true in terms of his personal ambition, but I think he viewed it more in the sense that the masses are too uneducated for me to explain to them the way that I'm thinking politically. So I have to create this myth for them to bring them together around this notion that they can grasp that the Quran is the political constitution and not just a moral or religious document. And so by proposing that publicly, he was preaching to the masses, while within his own circles, we know from reading his letters and other things after his death, he really had no use for religion. He was what he was called then a free thinker. Whether he was an atheist or not, I don't know. Perhaps that's the best way to describe it. But he was somebody who saw religion as a tool rather than as a fundamental true belief system.
And I think that was really so important that he really was using religion and this whole idea to pursue an agenda that he had. And, you know, as I've read your story, it, obviously there was a powerful force around this. I mean, anybody can get up and talk about religion, but you don't get to be the prime minister of a country. You don't get to travel all over. You don't get the following he had unless there was some sort of a force behind him. Did you ever have that feeling as you analyzed this? Was this his brilliance, or was this his charisma, or was there some sort of a force that was pushing him?
No, he clearly latched on to the imperial powers. His main voyage, which brought him to public prominence, is when he traveled from India to Egypt aboard a British vessel, where he was, you know, shown great deference and was clearly brought over to Egypt by British intelligence because they believed that he was a charismatic figure and someone who was willing to work with the British colonial office to advance British interests in that whole area between India and the Mediterranean that they considered the heart of their empire.
And so really the British were using Afghani was using the British. Was that the force then that you think was propelling him?
Well, for most of his career, I would say that's true. And certainly when he was in India, certainly when he was in Egypt, for a time he lived in Paris and he published a journal there called The Indissoluble Bond, and that became one of the landmark newspapers or magazines of the pan-Islamic movement. And apparently at that point he was getting some support from the French secret services. He also went to Russia and tried to get the Tsar's support. Apparently he had somewhat fickle loyalties. But I would think, aside from his voyages to France and Russia, I think primarily he was allied with the British during most of his career.
All right, friends, for our listeners out there, this is a gentleman named Afghani. And, of course, Afghani then was the grandfather of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it was two generations later than in 1928 when the Muslim Brotherhood is created in Egypt, and this becomes the father of what we really see as Al-Qaeda today. And, of course, Muslim Brotherhood was aligned with Saudi Arabia. And then after the Second World War, the United States was backing both the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia and the Muslim Brotherhood. because they were opposing the Arab nationalists. And of course, yes, many times the Arab nationalists were not anti-communists. And this is one reason why we disliked Nasser so much. And, of course, why we opposed Nasser, because I don't think he was a communist, but he certainly was not pro-Western. And anyway, we'll be back in this in just a moment or two, because this is an important part of the history. If you don't understand the past, you can't understand the present. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and for our listeners, it was Nasser came to power in 1952 or 1953, and then ruled up through 1970. He played an important part in the crisis that occurred in the late 1956, when, of course, they had the revolt in Hungary, and at the same time they had the attempt, the British and the French, to seize the Suez Canal. But you tell this story. You know it far better than I do. Where does Nasser fit into this whole thing? Where does the Muslim Brotherhood fit in as far as Nasser is concerned?
Well, at first, I think the United States and the CIA under President Truman looked somewhat favorably on Nasser, because they thought that the king of Egypt was a decrepit old man and someone who couldn't hold the country together. But Nasser came to power at a time when all over the so-called Third World there were stirrings of anti-colonial leaders and independence-minded leaders and so forth. Certainly Nasser was not a communist. He appealed to the United States first for military aid and arms, and he appealed to the United States for economic aid to build the Aswan Dam. But by the time the Eisenhower administration had come in, we had leaders in Washington who didn't like independent-minded leaders like Nasser, because even if they weren't communists, they weren't willing to join alliances, and that was the word of the day. We were creating military alliances, and so was the Soviet Union, which had the Warsaw Pact, where we set up NATO. We were creating CETO and CENTO and the Baghdad Pact, and Nasser didn't want any of that. He certainly wasn't joining those Soviet alliances, but he was appealing to the United States, support me as an independent leader, and there were people in the CIA who agreed with that, who said, yeah, Nasser is the future of the Arab world. He's modern, he's charismatic, he has a lot of influence. But in the end, the British view and the French view prevailed. And we supported the colonial powers. We tried to replace them in places where they were withdrawing because their empires were shrinking. And so Nasser became viewed as someone who was untrustworthy, dangerous, and unreliable. And of course, Nasser, after getting turned down by the United States when he tried to buy arms in the West, turned to Czechoslovakia, which was part of the Soviet bloc. And that confirmed the worst suspicions of the British and the Americans, who said, aha, you see, he's a communist after all. And so from that point on, there was a continual effort to undermine or destabilize Nasser, to weaken him. And because of the power of Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood was by far the strongest opposition force inside Egypt. And so the United States, and especially the British, which were still then strong in that part of the world, started playing around not only with the Muslim Brotherhood, but with Saudi Arabia, which supported these Islamist forces in Egypt.
And so basically what we were doing was trying to destabilize Nasser's government. We wouldn't like anybody coming in here and trying to destabilize our government, but we went into Egypt and we tried to destabilize the man who was running that and really wasn't doing too bad a job, trying to improve the lot of the tragic people there within Egypt. And of course this takes, well, we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Dreyfus, and and we're talking about his book, The Devil's Game. That's Robert Dreyfuss. The book is The Devil's Game. And, you know, I think it's very, very important that the people, there's a wonderful quotation in the book but from Nasser, and he's writing to President Kennedy. He's saying, you Americans never make stupid mistakes. You make complicated, stupid mistakes, so we can't figure out that maybe we've missed something about what you're doing.
Yeah, well, you know, the turning point in the relationship with Nasser and the Muslim Brotherhood was in 1954, the Muslim Brotherhood tried to assassinate Nasser. And he struck back at the organization with, you know, full force of his police and his security services and forced many of their leaders into exile. But at that point, the United States still had the choice of supporting or opposing Nasser. And the quote that you referred to really refers to Nasser's surprise when we suddenly, in the United States, upped this to support King Faisal in Saudi Arabia, who was busily trying to create an Islamic bloc. And we had the Eisenhower Doctrine, which closely bound us to Saudi Arabia, which was seen by almost every Arab as a reprehensible, greedy, and dissolute monarchy. And yet, that became our principal Arab ally. So we aligned ourselves with the worst, most despised forces in the Arab world and ended up opposing Nasser, who fought a series of overt and covert wars against Saudi Arabia, most notably in Yemen. There was a war that raged throughout the 1960s in Yemen between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And throughout this, the Muslim Brotherhood was the principal opposition force inside Egypt. So the idea, and we now know that Saeed Ramadan, for instance, who was one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, had officially signed on, according to German archives that have been uncovered and other work that's been done by me and a reporter in Switzerland and others. We know that Ramadan was an official agent of the CIA, and I found a photograph of him in the Oval Office with President Eisenhower.
Now, Ramadan was basically the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, wasn't he?
He was their chief international organizer.
Okay.
He'd been expelled from Egypt by Nasser, so he settled in Switzerland, and he set up a Islamic center in Geneva, which became kind of the nerve center for the worldwide Muslim Brotherhood. I don't think he ever achieved the title of, leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. That was reserved for someone who stayed in Egypt.
Oh, no, but of course,
he was their main organizer.
How did he finance this? Was he financed, do you think, by the intelligence agencies when he was in Switzerland? Because you just don't go to live in Switzerland, you know, and put out a magazine. You got to have money.
Well, it was more than a magazine. He had a whole institution there, a major Islamic center, but it was heavily funded by Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
The Saudis and the king of Saudi Arabia personally put a great deal of money into Ramadan's work.
Well, of course, are we backing Saudi Arabia? Are we doing everything we can to keep them in power?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course, we were most of all interested in the oil and not the royal family.
Well, of course, the royal family was the key to the oil. We had contracts. American companies had contracts with the royal family, so we were going to see they stayed in power, even though they were ruthless. I mean, they mistreated women. They cut off people's hands and heads and all sorts of, just like the Taliban was doing, really.
Well, not only that, but massively corrupt and so forth. And it wasn't just that we had contracts. At the time, until the mid-1970s, Saudi Arabia's oil was actually owned by the four big American oil companies. The company Aramco was completely owned and operated by ExxonMobil, Chevron, and Texaco. And the Saudis didn't even have any say in it. This was at a time when the oil companies ruled international oil, and none of these Arab countries or OPEC didn't even exist until much later. I mean, this was at a time when the oil companies really ran the international oil business and were the real kings of Saudi Arabia.
And, of course, well, basically that we were backing the people. The Saudi government was backing the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, the Saudi government was backing the Wahhabis. And the Wahhabis and the Muslim Brotherhood are really the foundation of what we call Al-Qaeda today, aren't they?
Yes, it's several generations from the time we're talking about until Al-Qaeda was formed. But ideologically, the Muslim Brotherhood grew ever more radical as time went on.
All right.
Refined its ideology.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Robert Dreyfus. His book is Devil's Game. And basically, could you explain to our listeners why you call it Devil's Game? You know, because what you're really inferring is that we sort of created the devil, or at least we worked with the devil.
Well, I see the words Devil's Game as really referring to a game that you can't win because the other side is devilish or has stacked the deck against you. I think when you play with religion, you're playing with a force that is far more volatile and dangerous, kind of like nitroglycerin, than just normal political games. And so I think ultimately it was a devil's game because we were, destined to be outflanked and outfoxed and to lose. And I think that's what ultimately happened when the movement of political Islam grew faster and extended broader than we ever believed it could, and in many respects, got out of control, sometimes without us realizing what was in fact happening.
Well, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood still seemed to be more or less centered in Egypt. And, of course, as time went by, of course, we're in the 1980s, then, of course, we have the Muslim Brotherhood actually killing Anwar Sadat, really in reprisal for the fact that he had signed a peace treaty, a peace agreement with Israel. And, of course, then we get the Mubarak, who's there today. But certainly the Muslim Brotherhood then has always been in resistance against the government there in Egypt. But we were always backing we were backing the government on one hand. We were backing the Muslim Brotherhood with the other. Didn't we continue with one hand backing the Muslim Brotherhood at the same time we were supposedly buddy-buddy with Anwar Sadat and then Mubarak?
Well, even Sadat himself. What happened was after Nasser died in 1970, who had strongly repressed the Muslim Brotherhood, Sadat became president, and he brought the Muslim Brotherhood back into Egypt, in part to help him create a political base for himself, because he came into power with very little political support. And Sadat himself, used the Muslim Brotherhood against the pro-Nasser forces in Egypt. And that's one of the great ironies of history, because he actually brought back into Egypt, led, by the way, by Saeed Ramadan, who we talked about earlier, and financed by Saudi Arabia. He brought the Muslim Brotherhood back into Egypt.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Dreyfus. His book is Devil's Game, and we recommend the book. And if you'd like to know more about it, you can give us a call at 1-800-454-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And you really need to get the interviews we've done with Mr. Dreyfus, give you tremendous insight into the background. But Mr. Dreyfus was talking about how Anwar Sadat, after Nasser died in 1970, then, of course, Sadat comes to power. And what does he do? He brings back the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I think he had actually been a member of that, hadn't he, or been affiliated with it?
Yes, in the 1940s, Anwar Sadat was a member of the Brotherhood, and for a time, until it was banned, he was Nasser's liaison to the Muslim Brotherhood.
So he comes into power, Sadat comes into power, he wants to use the Muslim Brotherhood as his political base, and so he brings them back in. They've been outlawed, they've been driven out of Egypt, he brings them back in, and then what happens?
Well, he allowed them and, in fact, encouraged them and even provided government funds for them to take over a number of institutions, and they began to take over the Lawyers Guild and the Engineers Guild and various medical societies. They began to establish themselves in universities. They started to create Islamic banks. It was like they began penetrating almost every part of Egyptian society. And people who went to Egypt at this time were stunned at how this country, which had been so secular in the 1960s, 10 years later, had become so religious, and men wearing beards and women wearing headscarves and covering up. And so this penetration of the Brotherhood went into every nook and cranny of Egyptian society. And
but didn't they more or less force this upon the Egyptians? In other words, it wasn't necessarily they wanted to, but weren't they just sort of using almost intimidation to get everybody to go along with a more radical form of Islam?
Well, I don't know if that's true, Dr. Stan. I think that you'd find that there was a ready-made constituency for this outlook, in part because people were poor and angry and frustrated, and of course there'd been the catastrophic loss of the 1967 war with Israel, and a lot of people blamed Nasser for that defeat, and so the ideology of Arab nationalism had been greatly weakened, and people were looking for answers. And so then the Muslim Brotherhood comes and says, "Islam is the solution." That was their slogan, and it was appealing to a minority, perhaps, of the population, but certainly a significant minority. And they gained strength, and Sadat encouraged them. And then they spawned ever more radical offshoots and branches. And it was one of those, namely Egyptian Islamic Jihad, that turned around and assassinated Sadat in 1981. So he only lasted 11 years as president. And I guess the most ironic thing about that is that when Sadat was assassinated, he was busy helping the CIA bring together worldwide Islamic radicals to fight in Afghanistan. He was shipping Egyptian radical Islamists to Afghanistan. He was training Afghans. He was, this was a blunder of colossal proportions for Sadat, because he was working with the very forces that ended up killing him.
But, of course, we were doing the same thing. During the Afghan war, the CIA was recruiting these radical mujahideen, these holy warriors, from all over the world and bringing them to Afghanistan and indoctrinating them in this radical form of Islam. And, you know, we've even got some material. I don't know if you know John Cooley's book on holy wars. He talks about how the CIA was distributing Korans to these fighters, and you know, it was the battle against the infidels, kill the infidels. Weren't we actually promoting this radical form of Islam in Afghanistan during the 1980s?
Well, far worse than distributing Korans, which I wouldn't personally object to. We were teaching them how to make car bombs. We were teaching them how to do assassinations.
And we were actually training them, some of them, right here in the United States, and then sending them back again. I know I had Colonel Bo Greitz was teaching a lot of these Afghans right over here in the desert in Nevada. Of course, we're not supposed to be involved in other people's affairs, and we were determined we were going to wage a war over there. It was a CIA war.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And of course, it wasn't just Afghanistan. There were many people in the Carter administration and then in the Reagan administration who believed that Islam was a sword that could strike at the Soviet Union itself by rousing up the Muslims of Central Asia. And that became kind of a mini crusade for a while, the idea that the Soviet Muslims in what's now Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and the other Central Asian republics, Kazakhstan, well, all of those countries were then part of the Soviet Union. And so while this fighting was going on in Afghanistan, there was this notion that maybe it would inspire Muslims in the Soviet Union to rise up. So we were completely oblivious to the fact that we were creating a permanent radical religious army.
So like Dr. Frankenstein had no idea what he was creating.
That's right. And even there were people who said after the Shah collapsed in Iran and Ayatollah Khomeini came into power, which was 1979, the same year that the Afghan war started. Well, there were people who said, maybe this isn't so bad because maybe Khomeini will himself inspire Muslims in the Soviet Union. And I found a great quote from Zalmay Khalilzad, who's now our ambassador in Iraq, in which he wrote for the RAND Corporation about 1980, a paper saying that maybe Ayatollah Khomeini will be the undoing of the Soviet Union, and he's creating an Islamic movement that is already being felt in the Soviet Union and in Iraq. Now here's the man who's now the ambassador to Iraq dealing with that Islamic fundamentalist power that he was 25 years ago lauding and praising because it was going to weaken the Soviet Union and weaken Iraq, which was seen as a Soviet ally at the time.
Well, it's a fascinating, fascinating story, and I certainly commend you for writing it. I'm going to let you go because I know you have something else, but I just wanted you to briefly mention the relationship between the CIA and Israel and Hamas. Now, Hamas, everybody knows, is the enemy of Israel. Hamas is already radical. It's sort of an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood, this intense hatred of Israel. But didn't some of the Israelis play a hand in creating Hamas?
Oh, that's a fascinating story, and you're absolutely right. I mentioned earlier how Nasser had suppressed the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, at the time, what's now Gaza, the Gaza Strip, came under Egypt. And then in 1967, the Israelis occupied Gaza, took it over, along with the Sinai Peninsula, of course. And when they went into Gaza, where there were many thousands of Palestinian refugees, they freed all the members of the Muslim Brotherhood who'd been arrested by Egypt. And one of those was Ahmed Yassin, who was a radical preacher who founded Hamas in 1987, 1988. Well, this was back in 1967. And for the next 20 years, the Israelis encouraged Yassin. They helped the Islamists in the West Bank and in Gaza build a political force that they thought, the Israelis thought, would undermine the PLO and Yasser Arafat. Now, not all Israelis, by the way. I've been told, and I put in my book, that Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, thought this was completely dumb for the Israeli military occupation authorities to support the Islamists, because maybe they had Mossad had a better idea of what a danger this was. But still, the Israeli occupation authorities went ahead and allowed this movement to prosper. And it grew, and there were even clashes between Hamas, the early Hamas movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the PLO all over the West Bank at universities. So this movement grew and took root and finally established itself with Israeli support to the great then backfiring result that it turned into Israel's bitterest enemy. And as we know from today's news, the Palestinians are holding elections just about now in the West Bank and Gaza. And it looks like Hamas, if it doesn't win those elections, will do so well that it will cause an enormous problem for Israel, for the United States, and others, who then have to decide how do we deal with a new Palestinian government in the occupied territories that is heavily influenced by Hamas, which is considered a terrorist group, which is responsible for many of the suicide bombings and other carnage in Egypt, as distinct from the other Palestinians who sometimes engage in fighting Israel over the occupation, but try to veer away from suicide bombings aimed at civilians and restaurants and things like that. So you have now Hamas emerging as a major political force in the new Palestinian government. And so I guess the moral of this story is Israel made the same mistakes on a much smaller scale that the United States made on a much larger canvas. Their canvas was really just the tiny occupied territories around Israel. But we were supporting, that is the United States, Islamist groups from Morocco to Indonesia into Central Asia, and so on a much bigger scale and much bigger scope.
Yeah, well, we could go on and on, but I know you have another obligation. I hope we can get you on to one of our other programs again, but thank you so very much for being with us. So I guess
it's a pleasure to be on your show, and if you don't mind, I'd mention my website.
Well, go right ahead, please.
People can go and read not only about the book, but my articles and other things. It's just my name, Robert Dreyfus, like the actor, Robert Dreyfus.
That's with two S's?
Yes, Dreyfuss,
RobertDreyfuss.com. Right. RobertDreyfuss.com. Fascinating information. Thank you so very much for being with us. I know it's getting late where you are, and we'll look forward to talking to you some other time, but thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Good night. And, of course, we're going to have open lines. We've got about 15 minutes before our next exciting guest, but our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I'd like to suggest that sometimes a lot of things don't make mistake, or we get this impression, oh, we just made another mistake. Oh, shucks, we just got such incompetent people. And I would like to suggest we do not have incompetent people. We have brilliant people who are orchestrating this whole situation. And if you follow the history of the Muslim Brotherhood, one of the men who planned the assassination of Anwar Sadat was the blind sheik Omar Rahman. And Rahman was then arrested by the Egyptians and thrown into prison. But if you read the book Unholy Wars by James Cooley, who was a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, he will tell you, as you know, that all the evidence suggests that the CIA got Rahman out of prison in Egypt. And then the next thing you know, why they're making arrangements for him to get a visa to come to the United States. So Omar Rahman is really a radical. He's a revolutionary. He's part of this whole radical Muslim Brotherhood. He wants violence. He's preaching violence and killing. So the CIA bring him to the United States, and he gets set up in a mosque. I believe it's in Brooklyn. And the next thing you know, why he's sending over to the Arab countries to get a bomber to blow up the World Trade Center. And of course, eventually he gets arrested and put into prison. But he sets up a whole terrorist system over here. Now, why would the CIA do something that stupid unintentionally? Why would they get this radical member of the Muslim Brotherhood out of prison in Egypt? Get him a visa to get in the United States. You're not supposed to bring terrorists in the United States. Those of you who have never seen the video, Jihad in America, you really need to get it. It was put together by Stephen Emerson. It was first shown in 1994 and then banned. Somebody put orders out. It was not to be shown in America, and it was not available at all until after 9/11. Why? Because it's got all sorts of footage in there. It had to be shot by our intelligence agencies in 1988, and 1999, and 1990, and it shows them Arab radicals. Abdullah Azzam, who was the man who formed al-Qaeda after the Afghan war, he's over in talking in Oklahoma City, talking about jihad and blood running in the streets and the violence they're going to perpetrate here in the United States. And then, of course, he gets killed I believe, in 88. And everybody thinks it's Osama bin Laden has done that. I suspect maybe he had a little help from the CIA, because now Osama bin Laden takes control of the world terrorist movement. And then the following year, you have pictures of other radical people from al-Qaeda talking in Oklahoma City and other major cities. They've got pictures of the terrorist training camps, and the government knew all about it. Believe me, they knew who every radical was in this country, that thoroughly infiltrated this whole movement. And this is the one thing that people don't understand, that our intelligence agencies, and there are 14 of them, they're not CIA and FBI, and maybe the NSA, there are 14 intelligence agencies, they're very effective. We know that they say, oh, we couldn't infiltrate the Islamic terrorist movement, but then we find out that a couple of the terrorists were moving with an FBI informant in San Diego. And of course, they couldn't infiltrate the Islamic movement. They didn't know anything about it. This Massoui, he was up there in Minneapolis. He was the 20th hijacker, supposedly wanted to learn how to fly a 747. Didn't want to learn how to take off and land, just wanted to learn how to fly it. And the people up there said, this guy's got to be a terrorist of some sort. If he knows how to fly this plane, he could fly it into a building. They reported to the FBI. The FBI wants to, locally in Minneapolis or Minnesota, want to go through his desktop computer. And the FBI in Washington, D.C. will not allow that. And they checked over in France. They found out this man was a terrorist. He'd been part of the terrorist network. The French knew all about him. And the Americans knew all about him. But the Washington office just wouldn't let anybody go through his desktop computer. And then, of course, we're told, the trouble was our FBI was just so incompetent. I mean, there was the Phoenix memo that had come in, and that was from the FBI station chief in Phoenix, who was saying there were so many of the Islamic people who were learning to fly planes that he thought maybe they were preparing for a terrorist attack. But Washington, D.C. just couldn't connect that, couldn't connect the dots. How many times have you heard that? And they're lying. I personally interviewed the woman who ran the flight school in Norman, Oklahoma, and she told me that 11 days before 9/11, the FBI was there checking on Zacharias Massoui. They knew everything about him. He was somehow or other, he was tied into a man named Nicholas Berg. You remember Nicholas Berg? He was that fellow that was captured by the radical Islamists and beheaded. He was wearing a official army jumpsuit, the most amazing thing you've ever seen. How many terrorist groups do you think have orange jumpsuits like they have at Guantanamo? We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. One of the hardest things for people to understand is that so much of what goes on today is all manipulated. The battle between communism and capitalism was manipulated from the very beginning, and those of you who have read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will see from the very inception of communism in 1917 and 1918, it was largely financed by American corporations and American banks, and we're getting all sorts of support from key people, figures right here in the United States. Get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and read it. There's a wonderful article there by... excerpts from a book called Imperial Agent by our British agent, perhaps it is, by Bruce Lockhart, who was sent to Russia in 1918 by Lord Milner, who headed Cecil Rhodes Secret Society at that time. And Bruce Lockhart can't understand why he's there, and wherever it is, St. Petersburg, I guess it is, Lenin is coming to him for advice, and to a man named Fred Thompson, who represents William Boyce Thompson, head of the Federal Reserve System, or member of the Federal Reserve, and he and this other American are called into all the communist meetings, and Lenin is coming to them for advice, and poor old Bruce Lockhart doesn't understand how the game is played. All he's there is just to relay information on what's going on back to Lord Milner. But, of course, if you read a lot of the literature that came out at the time of the Revolution, many people think that Lord Milner was behind the revolution and intentionally brought it about. And then you get into, of course, the consistent funding of communism since its very inception, nothing as it appears to be. Recently, in this last week or so, it's come out that the number two man of the Irish Republican Army, this vicious group of people who are blowing things up and killing people there in Northern Ireland, who is actually a British agent. The chief torturer, this is another gentleman, who tortured people and killed people for the Irish Republican Army over a period of 20 or 30 years, was a British agent. Could it possibly be that nothing as it appears to be? It's only recently come out now that the whole of the IRA from the very, very top was infiltrated by British agents. Here in the United States, we know that the mafia was thoroughly infiltrated by people working for the FBI, and when we get back, I'll tell you the story of Whitey Bulger, a man who killed 20 people and tortured many of them to death right here in the United States, I think it was in the Boston area, while he was in the employ of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the office in Washington, D.C. knew everything about it. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and there's a wonderful book. We don't carry it anymore. It's suddenly out of print, but it's called Deadly Alliance. It was written by a reporter from the Boston Globe, as I remember, who, incidentally, I tried to get on my program, and I think he was afraid to come on. But it was the story about the fact that the mafia in the United States was thoroughly infiltrated by our government and our government agents. And one of them was a man named Whitey Bulger, who for 20 years was an FBI informant with the mafia. During that period of time, he killed over 20 people, tortured many of them to death. The local authorities kept wanting to get him, and the FBI would always, of course, let him know ahead of time so he could escape. And eventually, of course, he did escape, thanks to being informed by his local FBI handler. And Washington, D.C. knew exactly what was going on. They sent an innocent man to prison for 30 years to cover for the crimes of Whitey Bulger. And that is a book called Deadly Alliance. You can probably get it in some of your stores. Of course, if you've read the book Double Cross, which we do have, written by the brother of the head of the mafia, he will tell you how the mafia worked consistently with the CIA. And Sam Giancano, Chuck Giancano's brother, Chuck writes the book, and we have the book. If you haven't read Deadly Alliance by a Double Cross, why, we do have that one. And you get into the background of this incredible story. How could this sort of thing happen in America? The American Communist Party was thoroughly infiltrated of our intelligence agencies. It was simply a shell here. They were simply watching everything they did. The militia movement here in the United States was largely financed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the other intelligence agencies. And this is the way the game is played all throughout the world. And yet they would try to convince you, oh, shucks, that we had no idea who any of those Muslims were. And then we find out about Abel Danger, and one of our intelligence agencies has known all about Muhammad Atta a year beforehand. In fact, when they actually had the 9/11 Commission hearings, and we have the staff report, they had pictures of Muhammad Atta taking money out of an ATM machine. I believe it was in February or March before the September attack. Where did they get those pictures? They had to be watching him. They knew where all of these people were because one of the hijackers had actually defected to the United States in April of the year 2000. You probably never heard of it, but it was brought out in the initial investigation that was known as the Joint Intelligence Committee investigation. If any of you would like to see the page from the testimony of Elder Hill on the 18th of September 2002, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And one of the hijackers walked into the office in New Jersey, FBI office, and said, I'm trained as a hijacker. We've been in Pakistan. They trained us how to hijack your planes. I'm part of a team. We're going to hijack them, and I want to turn myself in. And you know what the FBI did? They gave him a lie detector test. They figured he was telling the truth. They gave him another lie detector test. He passed it with flying colors. And what did Washington, D.C. do? You would think the intelligent thing was to try to get the rest of the hijacking team, wouldn't you? Wouldn't that what a logical person would do? But did they do that? No. In April of 2000, a little over a year and a half before the 9/11 attack, they got him out of the country as fast as they could. Why would they have done that? How did they know within 24 hours who all the hijackers were after September 11th? Nothing as it appears to be. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And our web space, radioliberty.com. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.